and they wanted a family version of the game. This meant, first of all, getting rid of the blood. Second, they didn't like the fact that players could shoot dogs. Why not substitute something else, Nintendo suggested, like rats? This being Nintendo, id agreed. Even more ironic was an offer from a company called Wisdom Tree, makers of religious-themed games. One day, a representative called Jay to inquire about licensing the Wolfenstein engine to make a game based on the story of Noah's Ark. They wanted a first-person 3D version in which the player was running around the Ark and hurling apples and vegetables to keep the animals in order. Jay had a good laugh. Nintendo, he knew, didn't allow any kind of religious imagery in a game, whether Satan or Noah. But Wisdom Tree had plans of its own, putting the game out independently as a rogue title for the Super Nintendo. Jay agreed to license them the technology. For the time being, though, there was something more important to attend to: CarMax technology. He returned to the id apartment with the results of his labors on the Shadowcaster engine. It was, everyone immediately saw, quite a leap. There were two noticeable firsts: diminished lighting and texture-mapped floors and ceilings. Diminished lighting meant that, as in real life, distant vistas would recede into shadows. In Wolfenstein, every room was brightly lit, with no variation in hue. But, as any painter knows, light is what brings a picture to life. Carmack was making the world alive. For greater immersion, he had also learned how to apply textures to the floors and ceilings, as well as add variable heights to the walls. The speed was about half that of Wolfenstein, but since this was an adventure game built on exploration, it seemed appropriate to have a steadier pace. The leaps didn't come easily to Carmack. It took a hefty amount of time for him to figure out how to get just the right perspective down for the floors. But his diligence and self-imposed isolation had paid off in a big way. He even had slopes on the floors so the player could feel like he was running up or downhill. Kevin spent about 20 minutes just running up and over a little hill in the game. It was incredible. And it was clear. It was time for id to turn this technology into their next game. With Wolfenstein and Spear of Destiny done, everyone, particularly Tom, was ready to move on to different subject matter. The last two games had drained him. Blocky maze games and shooters were nothing like Keen, and he was anxious to return to his pet project to finish his long-awaited third trilogy. Carmack, to his delight, seemed to go along with the idea. He even described how great it'd be to see the Yorps dancing around in three dimensions. There was another idea on the table, too. Aliens. Everyone at id was a huge fan of this sci-fi movie. They thought it would make a great game. After some research, Jay found that the rights were available. He thought they could get a deal, but then they decided against it. They didn't want some big movie company telling them what they could and couldn't put in their game. The technology Carmack had come up with was way too impressive to compromise, they thought. So it was back to the brainstorming. To Tom's dismay, the Keen 3D argument didn't go far. Carmack's technology was too fast and brutal for another kids' game, they all said. Tom looked to Romero, his friend and sidekick, but even he clearly didn't want to do the game. The computer bit in Romero's head flipped off for Keen. It wasn't surprising. Wolfenstein, after all, had originated with Romero, and clearly he preferred its gore to the cutesiness of Keen. Tom knew how Adrian felt. Even Carmack, who had once shown interest in Keen 3D, had moved on to another idea, something about as far removed from Keen as possible. Demons. Carmack, of course, had a long history with demons. There were the demons of Catholic school. the demons Romero had summoned in their Dungeons & Dragons game, the demons who'd destroyed the D&D world. Now it was time for them to make another appearance. Here was this amazing new technology, so why not have a game about demons versus technology, Carmack said, where the player is using high-tech weapons to defeat beasts from hell. Romero loved the idea. It was something no one had done before. Kevin and Adrian agreed, snickering at the potential for sick, twisted art, something in the spirit of their favorite B-movie, Evil Dead 2. In fact, they all agreed, that was what the game could be like. A cross between Evil Dead 2 and Aliens, horror and hell, blood and science. All they needed was a title. Carmack had the idea. It was taken from The Color of Money, the 1986 Martin Scorsese film in which Tom Cruise played a brash young pool hustler. In one scene, Cruise saunters into a billiards hall carrying his favorite pool cue in a stealth black case. "What you got in there?" another player asks. Cruise smiles devilishly because he knows what fate he is about to spring upon this player, just as, Carmack thought, id had once sprung upon Soft Disk, and as, with this next game, they might spring upon the world. "In here," Cruise replies, flipping open the case. Doom. Chapter 8. Summon the Demons. It was a scream from hell. A throaty cry, desperate, almost underwater, like somebody gargling blood. Worse, it was coming from right next door to the new office the id guys had christened Suite 666. Once id had decided to spring upon the world with doom, they'd relocated to this suitably dark workplace. A 7-story, black-windowed, cube-shaped building called the Town East Tower. The tower was, like the gamers themselves, an anomaly in the suburban cowboy domain of Mesquite. On either side of the bordering Lyndon B. Johnson Highway were the consumer biospheres indigenous to the area, Big Billy Barrett's used cars, Shepler's Western Store, and the city's biggest attraction, the Mesquite Rodeo. Though the tower housed ordinary offices of lawyers and truck driving schools, compared with the rest of town, the stealth cube looked like it had dropped from outer space. And now it sounded like someone was birthing an alien in the dentist suite next door. In actuality, it was a patient who needed an emergency tracheotomy, which the dentist had performed himself. The screams of patients and drills would become a regular backdrop of life at id. For a group of guys making a game about demons, they sounded just right. In fact, everything felt right for id that fall of 1992. Wolfenstein and Spear of Destiny were the talk of the computer and shareware magazines. Such accolades positioned id and its publisher, Apogee, as nothing less than the heroes of the shareware movement. The two companies dominated the shareware charts with two Commander Keen titles, Wolfenstein 3D, and Apogee's own original game, a side-scrolling shooter starring a brash, Schwarzenegger-style hero called Duke Nukem, occupying the top 4 positions. The press declared Apogee one of the most remarkable, if unheralded, success stories in the entertainment software industry. Apogee is ready to confront the big boys. One of the only companies, it seemed, not caught up in the fanfare over Apogee was id. The guys believed that Scott Miller, despite their friendship, had not been fulfilling his responsibilities. This information came from Sean Green, an Apogee employee whom Romero had befriended since Keen's release. Sean was a hardcore gamer and aspiring programmer from Garland, Texas. With long hair and a lust for loud rock music, he'd grown up as an outcast in his conservative town. required to attend night school because he refused to cut his hair. At Apogee, Sean toyed with people who would call in to complain about killing dogs in Wolfenstein by explaining that you can kill people too. He told Romero that there were more serious complaints. Calls from people who could not get through to order id's games. Apparently, many of the Apogee lackeys spent their days engaged in rubber band fights. Many were simply young students Scott had hired by putting up flyers in computer stores that said, "Do you like to play games? Can you handle talking on the phone and playing games all day for $6 an hour?" To make matters worse, there was no computer network. Orders were scrawled on scraps of paper and then jammed on metal spikes. Kevin Cloud, who was emerging as one of the more business-minded members of id, tried calling Apogee himself and found that he couldn't get through. Something had to be done. Sure, Scott was their friend, and he'd given them their start, but now he was unnecessary. Why give up 50% of their sales when they could do the self-publish completely on their own? Doom would surely be as big as, if not bigger than, Wolfenstein. Jay, Tom, Adrian, and especially Romero, who from the moment he suggested they leave Softdisk had always been looking for ways to grow the business, agreed. The only dissonant voice was Carmack. In an increasingly stark opposition to Romero, Carmack expressed a minimalist point of view with regard to running their business. As he often told the guys, all he cared about was being able to work on his programs and afford enough pizza and Diet Coke to keep him alive. He had no interest in running a big company. The more business responsibilities they had, things like order fulfillment and marketing, the more they would lose their focus making great games. Jay assured him that life would only get better. "We will truly become independent," he said. "We'll rely on nobody. We need to create our own opportunities. We don't wait for them to knock. We open the door, we grab opportunity by the scruff of the neck, and pull it through." Carmack could be left alone to work on his technology. Ultimately, he agreed. Scott had to go. Scott took the news in stride. In fact, he had suspected for some time that id would jump ship. He felt grateful that the relationship had lasted as long as it did. The id games had helped put Apogee on top, and by Scott and his partner, George Broussard, nice sports cars. By this time, id was also far from the only company making successful games for Apogee. Scott was continuing to publish many other authors, such as Tim Sweeney, a gifted programmer from Maryland who churned out popular titles under his company, Epic Mega Games. Apogee's own title, Duke Nukem, was number one on the shareware charts, right above Wolfenstein, with a sequel on the way. Though Scott didn't want to lose id, he was confident he'd survive. Scott Miller wasn't the only one to go before id began working on Doom. Mitzi would suffer a similar fate. Carmack's cat had been a thorn in the side of the id employees, beginning with the days of her overflowing litter box back at the lake house. Since then, she had grown more irascible, lashing out at passers-by and relieving herself freely around his apartment. The final straw came when she peed all over a brand-new leather couch that Carmack had bought with the Wolfenstein cash. Carmack broke the news to the guys. "Mitzi was having a net negative impact on my life," he said. "I took her to the animal shelter." "What?" Romero asked. The cat had become such a sidekick of Carmack's that the guys had even listed her on the company directory as his significant other, and now she was just gone? "You know what this means?" Romero said. "They're going to put her to sleep. No one's going to want to claim her. She's going down to Chinatown." Carmack shrugged it off and returned to work. The same rule applied to a cat, a computer program, or, for that matter, a person. When something becomes a problem, let it go, or, if necessary, have it surgically removed. Tom didn't like what he saw the moment he set foot inside the black cube. Compared with the creative boiler room atmosphere of the lake house and apartments, the new id domain felt isolated and detached. Everyone would have his own office. Everyone, it turned out, except Tom. On the first day, each guy chose his space. Carmack and Romero took side-by-side offices, while Adrian and Kevin, who were growing increasingly close, decided to share a space. Tom liked an open corner spot in a large room with a window. "This would be a great office area," he said. "We just need to put some walls up." The rest agreed. But the walls were slow to come. Whenever Tom asked Jay about it, Jay would say they were on their way. Out of humor and frustration, Tom put down two long strips of masking tape where the walls of what he called his creative corner would go. Those weren't the only invisible barriers around. Romero seemed to be pulling away, or, as Tom had often joked, flipping his bit from the moment they moved. Tom would sit at his desk behind his tape and watch Romero laughing down the hall with Adrian and Kevin. It felt sad to him, the inability to connect. Some of this, he thought, surely had to do with their emerging creative differences. There seemed to be a widening chasm between the factions of design and technology. It started the moment Romero chose Wolfenstein, a fast, brutal game that would emulate Carmack's graphics engine, over a more robust, character-driven world like Keen. Tom was still id's game designer, but he didn't feel like he was designing what he wanted at all. Yet, he held out hope that things might prove different for Doom. The early meetings suggested that they might. The discussions took place in a conference room overlooking the LBJ Highway through black Venetian blinds. Everyone sat around a large black table. Over pizza, they brainstormed about Carmack's Demons from Hell idea. They all agreed on making a fast action game that had the sci-fi suspense of Aliens combined with the demonic B-movie horror of Evil Dead 2. But Tom, who maintained the role of creative director, was determined not just to make another plotless first-person shooter. In Wolfenstein, there was no emotion, no feeling for the people getting blown away. Tom, who had left dead Yorps and Keen to impart a truer representation of death, wanted to bolster Doom with a more gripping kind of depth, something cinematic. "How about we tell this story of scientists on this moon at the butt end of space," he said, "and they're studying this anomaly, and it rips open, and they think aliens are coming out. But as you get further along, you realize it's mythological demons from hell, and that's like the shock. It gets creepier and creepier as you go on, and you have an episode where that's discovered, and there's like magnetic poles on the moon where there's two anomalies. So you go in and walk through a slice of hell, and you come out, and hell's come out in our dimension and perverted everything you're used to in the first episodes." Though Romero was somewhat supportive at first, Carmack had other ideas. "Story in a game," he said, "is like story in a porn movie. It's expected to be there, but it's not that important." Tom gnashed his teeth. "Furthermore," Carmack added, "the technology was going to be different this time around. He didn't want to do another game consisting of levels and episodes. Instead," he said, "we've got to make this one contiguous world, a seamless world. Rather than running through a door, say, and having an entire new level load up, the player would have a sense of invisibly progressing through one massive space." Tom hated this concept. It went against their winning formula. Players liked the sense of having completed one section or level of a game, then moving on to the next. He looked to Romero, but once again, Romero sided with Carmack. Tom returned to his desk to wait for his walls. Romero wasn't the only one realizing the importance of Carmack's vision. One afternoon, Jay and Kevin went outside for a smoke and talked about the company purchasing what was known as Key Man Insurance in case anything ever happened to Carmack. When Kevin suggested that the company buy the insurance for everyone else as well, Jay replied, "Everyone else is expendable." Because of his technological innovations, Carmack remained the resident dungeon master, the guy in charge, the one holding the rule book. It was clear that Doom would look like no other game. All the features Carmack had experimented with in the Shadowcaster engine were coming to life. Most notable were the diminished lighting effects, the concept that would allow a virtual space to fade gracefully to black. Carmack's first innovation was just to think up the idea of diminished lighting. But equally important, he was willing to make the difficult choices that would make this technology possible. That meant letting something go. Programming is a science based on limited resources. One can program only within the range of power available in a computer's hardware and software. In the fall of 1992, Carmack was still programming in VGA, which allowed only 256 colors. His challenge was achieving the effect of fading to black with these limited resources. The solution was to choose the colors on the palette so that there might be, for example, 16 shades of red, ranging from very bright to black. Carmack then programmed the computer to apply a different shade based on where a player was within a room. If the player walked into a big open space, the computer would make a quick calculation and then apply the darkest shades to the farthest section. As the player moved forward, the computer would brighten the colors. The colors nearer would always be brighter than the ones farther away. Cumulatively, the world would seem not only more real, but more evil. But this was not all. Both Carmack and Romero were eager to break away from the tile-based architecture of their earlier games. Keen and Wolfenstein were constructed like building blocks, piecing little square tiles of graphics together to make one giant wall. What the two Johns, particularly Romero, wanted now was to create a more fluid, free-form design. A world like the real world that could have walls of varying heights, rooms that felt huge, twisted, and strange. In Wolfenstein, walls had to be at 90-degree angles. In Doom, they would be at all kinds of angles. Carmack felt ready for the challenge. Computers were getting more powerful, and so were his skills. He began experimenting with ways to draw larger, more arbitrarily shaped polygons, as well as add textures to the ceilings and floors. When Romero looked over Carmack's shoulder, he was impressed, just as he had been on so many occasions before. Carmack explained his progress with diminished lighting and arbitrary polygons. He also talked about some other things he might do, make some special concessions so that hackers could more easily modify the game, as well as add some kind of networking component that could let players compete head-to-head. Romero immediately saw the potential in Carmack's technology. Potential that Carmack was, by his own admission, not capable of envisioning himself. And because Romero was a programmer, he could speak to Carmack in a language he understood, translating his own artistic vision into the code Carmack would employ to help bring it to life. The moment Romero saw the diminished lighting effects, his mind went to work imagining what effects he could design. "If you can change the light value," he said, "can we do it dynamically, like on the fly while the game's playing, or does it have to be pre-computed?" "Well," Carmack said, "I can make it dynamic." "Cool, then let's have strobes, you know? You're fucking running through a room and the lights flash off." Romero raced back to his office. He booted up the map editor, the programming template he and Tom would use to create the Doom worlds. Using it, again, was very much like designing architecture for a house. On screen, Romero would look at something resembling a flat overhead blueprint. By clicking his mouse and dragging down a line, he could draw a series of walls. With another click, he could switch the point of view to look at his creation from within the space. Adrian and Kevin, meanwhile, would provide the texture images, essentially the wallpaper, which a level designer could use to decorate a room's walls. With those map editing tools available, Romero was eager to use Carmack's innovations to bring Doom to realization. Carmack was doing amazing work. Romero knew this on two counts: as a programmer who appreciated Carmack's ingenuity, And, just as important, as a gamer who had never played through such worlds on a PC or any other platform for that matter. He played around with rooms that flashed strobe light, with walls that soared and receded at different heights. Every decision he made was based on how he could best show off Carmack's technology. Carmack couldn't have been happier. What more could someone want, after all, than to be both appreciated and celebrated? Romero was just as energized. With Carmack's innovations, he too could reach new heights. Tom, by contrast, felt himself sinking. Since their initial meeting about the game, he had been on his own writing up a treatment, known in the game industry as a design document, for Doom, fleshing out the characters, motivations, story. The game would begin, he wrote, with the player assigned to a military base conducting experiments on a distant moon. The experiments go awry, however, when the scientists accidentally open a portal to hell, releasing an onslaught of beasts, much like what happened with Romero in their Dungeons & Dragons game. The action would start with the player engaged in a game of cards with some other soldiers. Suddenly, a burst of light would flash, and the demons would come, ripping the player's best friend to shreds. Tom wanted to create an immediate sense of terror as the player watched his pal die a terrible instant death. He named the doomed character in the game Buddy, the same name as that of the Dungeons & Dragons character he'd played. But his work fell flat among his own friends. The first blow came when Carmack casually announced that he was no longer interested in pursuing a seamless world for Doom. The game could return to a more traditional level design. But I've spent the last 2 months writing a design document based entirely on that seamless world you wanted, Tom exclaimed. Carmack's remark meant that Tom had to revise everything he'd done. This Doom Bible is not helping us get the game done, Carmack said. Id had never written down anything in the past. Why start now? Doom didn't need a backstory. It was a game about fight or flight. The player just needed to be scared all the time. He didn't need to know why. Carmack told Tom to drop the Bible and start playing around with the technology like Romero was doing. I'm still working on this technology, he explained. But please, experiment. Figure out what can be done with this. He suggested Tom go to the library and check out some books about military bases to get some ideas. Romero agreed. Though he liked much of what Tom had put into the Doom Bible, a character-driven story was clearly not going in the same direction as Carmack's technology. There was no time for guys to sit around and play cards in Doom. Not only was the game going to be brutal and fast like Wolfenstein, but it was going to be even more brutal and fast. Tom gave up the story once and for all. But another story was falling into place for Id. In the company's brief history, a pattern was emerging that emulated Carmack's programming ideology. Innovate, optimize, then jettison anything that gets in the way. It happened in their games. How Keen was killed for Wolfenstein, how floors and ceilings were sacrificed for speed, and it happened in their lives. Alvacovius, Scott Miller, and even Mitzi the Cat had all been abruptly deleted from the program. It was impossible to know who or what could be next. Romero marched into the kitchen at Id, waving a crudely drawn caricature of Burger Bill, the renowned gamer rumored to keep hamburgers for days in his desk. Tom, Kevin, and Adrian followed, cackling. Romero stapled Bill's picture to the chair, then grabbed a steak knife from the drawer. It was time for revenge. Bill had been contracted by Id to convert or port Wolfenstein for the Super Nintendo. But with the deadline approaching, he still hadn't delivered an iota. He finally admitted that there was a problem. He had made the mistake of signing Id's contract while employed by the game publisher Interplay. His contract with Interplay stipulated that any work an employee did was property of the company. The Super Nintendo port, therefore, was now owned by Interplay. The id guys flipped. "See," Romero said, "this is just the kind of bullshit you get when you rely on other people." Tom took out a pencil and sketched a hideous caricature of Bill with burger meat dripping from his greasy mouth. Romero swiped it from his hands and said it was time for Bill to pay the price. In the kitchen, they took turns stabbing the picture, yelling and laughing and egging each other on. They began attacking the chair, knifing it, stomping it, trashing it. Days later, when Bill came to visit, the ruins were still on the floor. He took one look at the knife with his name scrawled on the blade and asked meekly, "What's this?" Then they fired him. Carmack would do the port himself. Such shenanigans were becoming par for the course. The guys had long engaged in a kind of competitive, creative hazing ritual known as the Rip-a-thon. They would take turns humiliating each other in some artistic way. Adrian programmed a screen opening so that when Romero turned on his computer, he'd see a doctored picture of himself engaged in compromising sexual acts. After Tom had some glossy headshots made of himself following Wolfenstein's success, Romero and Adrian went to town defacing them. The most elaborate example involved a bratwurst, clay testicles, and a can of whipped cream. Id's frat house even had its own house mother in the form of their office manager, Donna Jackson. Donna had a syrupy southern accent and big teased hair and was partial to bright pink business suits and matching rouge. She quickly took to the role of company matriarch. She made sure everyone was fed and happy and healthy, offering to get more junk food or soda whenever someone was down. When she arrived, her hobby was gambling in Shreveport casinos. She soon became an expert sharpshooter in Id's games. She called the Id guys, still in their early 20s, "my boys." The boys called her Miss Donna, or sometimes the Id Mom. But since Miss Donna was a mom for hire, no one was in fear of being reprimanded for their outbursts. Office destruction became sport. The office was strewn with broken keyboards, smashed monitors, broken discs. Romero might just walk up to Kevin and joke, "Hey, Kevin, that garbage can's calling you a sad motherfucker." Kevin would reply dryly, "It is?" before pummeling the can into the ground. More darkness was coming from the art room. Doom was precisely the kind of game Adrian had always wanted to do, something that could allow him to exercise his most nightmarish visions. Along with the others, he and Kevin dreamed up the most hideous creatures they could imagine. The Imp, a red-eyed Bigfoot-like beast with brown fur covering his muscles and metal spikes protruding from his shoulders and arms. The Demon, a snorting pink bull with blood-stained teeth and horns. And, meanest of all, the Cyber Demon, with a gun for an arm and a ripped-open torso. This time around, the monsters would look even more lifelike, thanks to a new animation technique. For Wolfenstein, Adrian had had to draw every frame, showing each character in several walking and running positions. Now they decided to try a mixed-media approach. They would sculpt the characters in clay, then shoot them in different positions on video. The video frames would then be scanned into the computer, colorized, and programmed as moving digital characters using a program Carmack wrote called the Fuzzy Pumper Palette Shop. "The overall effect is distorted," Kevin said. "But that's Doom." Adrian and Kevin had so much fun, they even began scanning themselves into the game. One day, Kevin rolled up his sleeve and stood behind the video camera with his arm extended in front of the lens, taking turns firing toy weapons. A plastic shotgun and pistol from Toys R Us, a chainsaw, like the one used by the hero of the movie Evil Dead 2, borrowed from a woman Tom had been dating. The video images would then be placed in the lower center of the game's frame, looking like the player was sighting down the length of his forearm, or, in actuality, Kevin's. Inspired, Adrian scanned a pair of his snakeskin boots, which he used to create a serpent-like texture for one level of the game. When Kevin came to work with a bloody wound on his knee, they scanned that in too, to use as a wall texture. In the strange emerging world of Doom, anything could go. By the new year, there was enough coming together that Tom typed up a press release. Dallas, Texas, January 1st, 1993. Heralding another technical revolution in PC programming, he wrote, id Software's Doom promises to push back the boundaries of what was thought possible on a computer. In Doom, you play one of four off-duty soldiers suddenly thrown into the middle of an interdimensional war. Stationed at a scientific research facility, your days are filled with tedium and paperwork. Today is a bit different. Wave after wave of demonic creatures are spreading through the base, killing or possessing everyone in sight. As you stand knee-deep in the dead, your duty seems clear. You must eradicate the enemy and find out where they're coming from. When you find out the truth, your sense of reality may be shattered. He touted the game's new improved technologies, texture-mapped worlds, non-orthogonal walls, and diminished lighting. For the hell of it, they threw in a teaser about multiplayer gaming, something they had yet to implement. Up to four players can play over a local network, Tom wrote, or two players can play by modem or serial link. We fully expect to be the number one cause of decreased productivity in businesses around the world. With the bar set, Tom, Romero, Adrian, Carmack, and Kevin had arrived at a genuine look and feel for the game. The player would progress while staring down the barrel of a shotgun jutting out in the lower center part of the screen. The rooms would unfold, dark, foreboding, mainly in grays, blacks, and browns, with an occasional royal blue floor. As originally intended, the walls were anything but 90 degrees. They were octagonal, tiered, with steps leading from one room to the next. Carmack had also devised a way to create windows within walls so a player could look from one room into another, though not know how to get inside. There were actual light sources in the games, strips of fluorescence on the floor or above, but the realism was punctuated by demonic monsters. In one section, a player would progress through a locker room, only to find a pink demon floating in the showers. By the spring, several of these levels were collected into an early demonstration, or alpha, of the game, which was distributed to friends, testers, and select members of the press. Computer Gaming World published a glowing preview. "We don't know what nasty sludge is seeping into the Texas water table," it read, "but whatever it is has given these boys some strange visions. And what's worse, the programming sorcery to carry it out. Doom is the name of their next creation, and unbelievable graphics technology is their game." Despite the enthusiasm, the two Johns were still not happy with Tom's work. Tom had taken Carmack's advice to study military architecture too much to heart. The levels he created had the banality of a real-life military base. He stuck stubbornly close to the scenario of his Doom Bible, creating a room even that showed a group of soldiers sitting around a table playing cards. Many of the rooms looked like actual offices, with gray walls, brown-tiled floors, and even office chairs and file cabinets. Tom was trying to appease Carmack at the expense of the game, Romero thought. So he decided to show how the design should be done, even if that meant Carmack would have to make his code faster. Romero retired to his office, cranked up Dokken, and got to work. Hours into the night, he pointed and clicked, dragged and dropped, creating lines on his map editor, switching back and forth into the first-person point of view. He knew what he was going for, to break out of the concrete box-like military bunkers and into something else, something big, expansive, twisting, weird, and abstract. After a series of late nights, the world emerged just as Romero wanted it, and when he pulled the others into his office, they stepped inside. It began in a room with a low gray ceiling but angled walls. Walking to the front right, they came to a wall with slats in it, open spaces that revealed an outdoor vista, a sky, but no apparent way to get out. Two large lights stripped the opening of a hallway. It seemed like the way to go. As one walked down the hall, the rooms opened up to a plank leading outdoors. There was a gray sky overhead, mountains off in the distance. But as one moved, the path only led back inside, now into a room with higher walls than the first. Lights flashed from overhead as a flurry of former humans, zombie soldiers possessed by demons, unleashed rounds of fire, emerging from the shadows with blood-stained chests. When Romero was through, everyone agreed. Tom's banal levels were out. Romero's were in. This was the design. This was doom. From that moment, Tom's attitude went from bad to miserable. It felt like everything he had done, everything he wanted to do, was getting thrown out. It was like the end of sixth grade, he thought, when some people are turning into jocks and some people are turning into geeks, and you get that realization that you're heading down the wrong path. Romero all but ignored him. No jokes, no destruction, no alien bleeps. The rest made him feel just as alone, striking down anything he would suggest for the game. It soon became too painful for Tom to be there. He found a girlfriend and began spending more time out of the office. Before long, Carmack pulled Romero aside and suggested they fire Tom. But Romero knew what such a change would mean. Though no owner had left or been fired before, the guys had decided how to deal with such a situation if it should ever arise. Just after they formed the company, they sat down and agreed wholeheartedly that the fate of id Software had to transcend the fate of the individual owners. They had seen the damage the infighting had caused Softdisk and were determined to insulate their own company from such demise. They made two agreements. First, there had to be a unanimous vote among the owners to ask someone to go. At the moment, Adrian, Romero, Tom, and Carmack were the main partners, with Jay and Kevin each owning smaller shares. Second, if an owner left, he would lose all his shares and have no future stake in the company. They didn't want anyone's departure to damage the success of id. Tom, in other words, would never see a penny from Doom, let alone Wolfenstein or Keen. He would be on his own. Romero convinced Carmack to give Tom another chance. Romero had other things on his mind as well. He was getting married again. His relationship with Beth, the former clerk at Softdisk, had become a deep and meaningful love affair. She could give him the space he needed to build his career as well as be in a relationship. She was fun, loved to cook, loved to have a good time. She didn't have any real interest in games, but at least he could continue doing what he most enjoyed. Over July 4, 1993, Romero spent his honeymoon in Aruba. When he came back, he was more energized than ever. Though he still maintained close contact with his sons in California, the years without a family in town had been tough. And his relationship with his ex-wife Kelly was only getting more strained. But now, he had a new wife, a new beginning. Money was rolling in from Wolfenstein to the tune of $100,000 per month. Doom had found its voice. All was well. All, he quickly discovered, but Tom. By now, Everyone else had had enough. They wanted him out. Finally, Romero gave in. He wanted to break the news to his old friend himself, so he invited Tom to his house for a meal home-cooked by Beth. Tom was delighted. He hadn't spent quality time with Romero for ages. The dinner was like old times. The two guys joking around, talking movies and games. Romero couldn't bring himself to break the news. The next day, a shareholders meeting was called. Tom walked in to find everyone sitting around the conference room table, staring at the floor. "Tom," Carmack finally said, "obviously this isn't working out. We're asking for your resignation." For Tom, the moment felt unreal. He heard Romero say something about how he'd tried to tell him about this last night, but just couldn't bring himself to do it. Tom could not even respond. He found a little sticker on the table, peeled it off, and began rolling it between his fingers. Despite all the warning signs, he hadn't seen this coming at all. He felt depressed, ashamed. Maybe this wasn't just about the games, he thought. He always felt like they resented his upbringing, the fact that he wasn't a delinquent or the product of a broken home. He was just this guy with doting parents and a college education. In a barely audible voice, he began defending himself, talking about all the things he could do for Doom. But there was silence in response. Soon, his voice faded too. They asked him to leave the room while they discussed the situation. As the door shut behind him, something in Tom shifted. A weight rose from his body. He had been so miserable for so long, so dejected, feeling so unwanted, he never had the gumption to recognize the situation for what it was and make a break. It was like those old job interviews when the men in suits kept asking him if the job they were offering was what he really wanted to do. At that time, he realized it hadn't been what he wanted. What he wanted was to make games. Now, 5 years later, he accepted that these were not the games he wanted to make. When he stepped back into the conference room, he said, "I think, guys, this is really the thing to do." His games at id were over. The others were just getting started. Chapter 9. The Coolest Game. John Carmack stood in the Ferrari dealership, admiring a cherry red 328 sports car, and had one thought. How fast can it go? As an engineer, he considered speed an efficient way to measure his progress. How much faster could he get the computer to render graphics on screen? A car was much the same. When Carmack looked at the sexy design of the body, he saw straight through to the engine. To the dealer's surprise, the wiry 22-year-old in t-shirt and jeans wrote a check for $70,000 and took the keys. It didn't take long for Carmack to feel that the car wasn't quite fast enough. His instinct was to get under the hood and start futzing around, just like he had with his MGB. But this was no ordinary car. This was a Ferrari. No one futzed with a Ferrari. The elite manufacturer had very low regard for anyone who dared mess with its pristine design. For Carmack, though, it was another machine to hack. With Romero's help, Carmack soon found someone who was more than up to the task, Bob Norwood. Norwood had been racing and building cars since he was a 13-year-old in Kansas. He held more than 100 spots in the Guinness Book of World Records for speed records in a variety of funny cars and, above all else, Ferraris. When Romero read in an auto magazine that Norwood now ran an auto shop in Dallas, he suggested Carmack give him a call. Carmack, as usual, was skeptical. Every other auto guy in town had shrugged off his request. "A Ferrari, eh?" they'd say. "Well, I guess we can put a new exhaust system on it." A new exhaust, Carmack knew, was a wimpy and ineffectual answer to his problem. When he drove into Norwoods, the crusty owner walked out with greasy hands. "I got this 328, Carmack said cautiously, "and I want it to be a little faster." Norwood squinted his eye and replied matter-of-factly, "We'll put a turbo on it." Carmack had found a new friend. For $15,000, Norwood rigged the Ferrari with a turbo system that would activate when Carmack floored the gas pedal. It was a ballsy bit of hacking, and Carmack immediately felt a kinship with the veteran racing man. The day it was finished, Carmack planned to celebrate by driving to his brother's graduation in Missouri. Though his success with Keene and Wolfenstein had helped him mend bridges with his mother, pulling up in a car like this was guaranteed to close the deal. He showed up at Norwood's with his duffel bag, threw it in the trunk, then hit the road. Just outside Dallas, he saw an open stretch of highway. Slowly, he pushed the pedal down to the floor. As it lowered, he felt a force build until the pedal hit the metal and the car accelerated almost twice as fast, reaching nearly 140 miles per hour. Life was good. He was living his dream, working for himself, programming all night, dressing how he pleased. All those long, hard years without a computer, without a hacker community, were fading behind him. Contrary to what the other guys might have thought, he did have feelings. And at this moment, with the cows and corn blurring beside him, he felt unbelievably happy. He drove the rest of the way with a huge grin on his face. His car wasn't the only engine Carmack wanted to go faster. Doom, though quick, was still not quite quick enough for his taste. The game had considerable challenges for speed, such as the textured ceilings and floors, as well as the walls of varying heights. While porting Wolfenstein to the Super Nintendo system, Carmack had read about a programming process known as binary space partitioning, or BSP. The process was being used by a programmer at Bell Labs to help render three-dimensional models on screen. In the simplest terms, it broke the model into larger sections or leaves of data as opposed to sluggishly drawing out many little polygons at a time. When Carmack read this, something clicked. What if you could use a BSP to create not just one 3D image, but an entire virtual world? No one had tried this. No one, it seemed, had even thought about this, because, after all, not many people were in the business of creating virtual worlds. With BSPs, the image of a room in Doom would be essentially split up into a giant tree of leaves. Rather than trying to draw the whole tree every time the player moved, the computer would draw only the leaves he was facing. Once this process was implemented, Doom, already fast, soared. To keep Doom's development going, however, Carmack, Romero, and the rest knew they had to deal with one pressing problem, replacing Tom Hall. As a friend, of course, Tom was irreplaceable, particularly for Romero. There was just no one who possessed that hysterically comic streak. Worse, the split from id was so painful that Romero and Tom had hardly spoken since the firing. But at least Tom had managed to land on his feet. Scott Miller, another casualty on the way to id's success, offered him a job as a game designer for Apogee. It was bittersweet, but Tom accepted. Maybe now he would be able to make the games he had always imagined. Back at id, the guys started sifting through resumes for a new game designer of their own. Kevin had received a resume from a promising-looking gamer named Sandy Peterson. At 37 years old, Sandy was ancient compared with the id guys and an admirable veteran of the gaming scene. In the early 80s, he had created a pen-and-paper role-playing game, Call of Cthulhu, that featured flesh-eating zombies and tentacle-legged alien parasites. The game became a cult favorite around the world, selling over 100,000 copies. Eventually, Sandy went on to create computer games at Microprose, a company in Baltimore founded by Sid Meier, legendary designer of the historically based strategy series Civilization. But Romero had a concern about Sandy. At the bottom of Sandy's resume, he noted that he was Mormon. "Dude," Romero told Kevin, "I don't want anyone who's religious here. We're fucking writing a game about demons and hell and shit, and the last thing we need is someone who's going to be against it." Nah, Kevin said. Let's just meet him. He might be really cool. Romero sighed. Okay, dude, but I wouldn't do it. Several days later, Sandy showed up. He was a heavy-set, balding guy with glasses and suspenders. He had a rapid-fire, high-pitched voice that got more excited as he spoke about games. Encouraged, Romero sat him down in front of a computer to see how he could put together a makeshift level of Doom. Within minutes, Sandy was drawing what seemed like a mess of lines on screen. Romero said, what are you doing here?
Well, Sandy chirped speedily, I'm going to have you come through here, and this wall's going to open up behind you, and the monster's going to come through it, and you're going down this way, and I'm going to turn the lights off and all this stuff.
All right, Romero thought. This guy's getting it, like bam. With Sandy on board as id's game designer, Romero would be free to do all the different things he enjoyed. Programming, making sounds, creating levels, overseeing business deals. Sandy was given an offer, but he told Jay he needed more money to support his family. Later that day, Carmack approached him and said, the stuff you've done is really good. I like your work, and I think you'd be good in the company. The next day, Carmack stopped him in the hall again. When I said your work was good, he said, that was before I knew that you'd ask Jay for more money. So I don't want you to think I told you your work was good in an attempt to get you to ask for less money. Then he walked off. It seemed to Sandy like a weird thing to say, as if Carmack thought that he could cajole him out of wanting a higher salary. He doesn't know anything about how humans think or feel, Sandy thought. It didn't take long for Romero to appreciate Sandy's speed, sense of design, and encyclopedic knowledge of games. Sandy regaled him about the payback a player should receive when blasting the lungs out of a demon with a shotgun.
You really should get rewarded on several levels, he said. You hear the gun go off. You see the big, manly guy cocking his shotgun. You see the bad guy go flying backwards or an explosion. It's always you're rewarded for doing the right thing.
Romero couldn't agree more, adding how, in addition to all that, there would be like tons of blood flying out from the beasts. They had a good laugh. Romero decided to probe the religious issues. So, he said, you're Mormon?
Yep, Sandy replied.
Well, Romero said with a chuckle, at least you're like not a Mormon that keeps pumping out tons of kids and stuff. Sandy stopped typing.
Actually, I've got 5 kids.
Oh, okay, Romero stammered. But that's not like 10 or anything. But, you know, 5's a lot, but, at least you're not a really hardcore card-carrying Mormon.
Oh, I got my Mormon card right here.
Sandy pulled it out. Well, at least you don't wear those garments and stuff, right? Sandy lifted his shirt. Got my garments on right here. Okay, Romero said. I'm going to shut up.
Look, Sandy said. Don't worry. I have no problems with the demons in the game. They're just cartoons. And anyway, he added, smiling, they're the bad guys.
While id refined Doom in September 1993, two sons of a preacher from Spokane named Rand and Robin Scott released Myst, a literary adventure computer game on CD-ROM. The game became an instant phenomenon, topping the computer game charts and eventually selling more than 4 million copies. It also popularized the burgeoning new format of CD-ROM. With the rise of CD-ROM drives on home computers, this spacious format, which could store hundreds of times more data than floppy disks, was becoming the it software for game developers. The extra space afforded better sound and even full motion video, effects exploited in a horror CD-ROM game called Seventh Guest, another chart topper. Shot in a photorealistic manner, Myst set players on a mysterious, abandoned island, where they were to explore strange rooms and machines and unlock the secret of their inventor, a man named Atrus. Like Doom, Myst unfolded from a first-person point of view. But in Myst, players didn't run, or, for that matter, crawl. They just slowly flowed. Clicking a space or item before them would gracefully fade one setting into the next. Its brilliantly designed and rendered 3D images, Wired magazine raved, and its funhouse world of mazes, puzzles, and human intrigues will certainly set a new standard for this type of adventure game. Id hated Myst. It had none of the elements they liked. No real-time interaction, no pace, no fear, no action. If Myst was like Shakespeare, Doom was going to be Stephen King. With Carmack's engine in gear, the rest of the team buckled down on finished elements of the game. Adrian and Kevin churned out dark, demonic art. They drew guys impaled, twitching on stakes, like the impaled farmer Adrian had seen at the hospital long ago. Blood-spattered corpses chained to walls. The death animations were more elaborate than ever. Monsters stumbling with their skulls ripped open. The Baron of Hell slumping forward with his intestines spilling onto the floor. The weapons were falling into place. The shotgun, the pistol, the chainsaw, a rocket launcher, and the affectionately named BFG, Big Fucking Gun. In Wolfenstein, if the player lost a gun, it would be replaced with the default weapon, a knife. In Doom, the player would be left to duke it out with his bare fists. They digitized Kevin's hand, slugging punches against a blue screen. The killer weapons and monsters needed suitably killer sounds. The guy signed Bobby Prince up again to record the audio. Under Romero's guidance, Bobby gave Doom a techno-metal-style soundtrack. A puree of animal groans were used for the game's beasts. With the guns and monsters and gore, Sandy and Romero went to town on the levels. Romero had found his voice in Doom. He loved everything about the game. The speed, the fear, the suspense, and he tried to play it all up. Romero's levels were deliberately paced. As level designer, he was responsible for not only designing the architecture of the environments, but also choosing where to put monsters, weapons, bonus items, and objects. It was like being a theater director and Haunted Mansion creator, all in one. Romero relished the roles. In a level of his, a player might run into a room and see a window leading outside, but wouldn't know how to get there. So the player would run down a room, music pumping, looking for a way. A door would slide open and boom, there'd be a howling imp. Blast that monster down, run down a brown spotted corridor, open another door, and blam, another herd of beasts. Romero had a knack for staging the battles, letting the player win one small round, then pummeling him with a storm of enemies. While Romero was raw and brutal, Sandy was cerebral and strategic. One level was littered with green barrels that, when shot, would explode. Sandy made levels in which the only way to kill a monster was to shoot a barrel at the perfect moment. His levels were not nearly as aesthetically pleasing as Romero's. In fact, some of the id guys thought they were downright ugly, but they were undeniably fun and fiendish. They complimented Romero's well. By the fall of 1993, the pressure was on as gamers began to clamor for Doom. A demonstration for the press leaked out onto the internet, despite id's best efforts. Small groups of diehard fans began calling the id office or sending desperate emails for information. But the mainstream